Good afternoon and good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to BBS Radio's The Higher Dimensions. I'm Phyllis Price, your hostess, and I am so delighted to welcome you this day. It's a dreary day in Washington, but what the heck, it's spring is coming and so is St. Patty's Day. But today I have a wonderful guest who's written some books, Mr. Frank Joseph. He's written the sagas of conquerors, castaways, and scoundrels. And he's also written some other books. He's done archaeology. There are some wonderful, wonderful books that he's written. And if they're all like these, like this one that I read, it's wonderful. I love it. At any rate, I am welcoming him today. Welcome, sir. How are you?
Thank you very much, Phyllis. It's going to be a pretty hard show to follow after an introduction like that.
Not a bit of it, sir. You've got the most wonderful things. I just love archaeology. I love things about ancient America. One of my ancestors was a Native American, and Cherokee, as a matter of fact. And I just happen to have a great passion for all things archaeological. I've been collecting stuff for years, including bullets from the Civil War for some property that we had, Indian arrowheads, and in a home that I had in Rappahannock, Virginia, Flint Hill, Virginia, we unearthed some, I guess, shale, you might call it, that had these one-celled and smaller tribolites and creatures from about 40, 50 or more million years ago, because the Blue Ridge Mountains are the oldest mountain range in the world. I guess you know that. And it was once part of the Great Sea.
Yes, that's correct. Well, and it sounds like you have a marvelous collection.
Well, I do. In fact, I even have a pipe from from Florida Indians, Seminole Indians way back when down in Florida, and some Anasazi, some Hopi, Aztec, Mayan. I've just picked up a whole bunch of different stuff. Just, you know, where my little paws found it.
Well, it sounds like you've got a wonderful sense of curiosity, and that's a great thing to fulfill it in finding these objects, which become more valuable over time. I don't mean in terms of money, but in terms of your own experience, they become far more valuable, and it's great that you've got a collection like that.
Well, I do. I enjoy it. I even have some oil lamps from the Negev Desert that were made about 100 years before Christ.
Oh, my gosh.
And, and it's just absolutely fascinating. When you look at that and think, well, this is a part of the biblical story of the ten foolish maidens and the ten wise maidens who filled their oil lamps waiting for the bridegroom to come. And these are the real deal. These are oil lamps. And you can see why they ran out of oil real quick, because the lamps in those days were very small. They fit in the palm of your hand.
They had all different sizes, actually. Some were quite large. Some were,
wow.
I was at the university, or rather at the museum in Minneapolis not too long ago, and they had an oil lamp that had positions for five different wicks, and it looked like it was about going on 3 feet long. And it was suspended by a chain from the ceiling. So they had, of course, that was Roman. But, there were all different. Of course, this appears to be that oil was a problem then in the Near East as it is now.
Absolutely. But these are small, and I think the potters who made them, because they look to be like they're made of clay, pottery clay, is that correct?
They had
signatures on the bottom, two different bakers. They had the name or a what would be a facsimile, a mark, as you would call it, to say who had created the pot, the little lamp. But at any rate, I digress. So anyway, what we're going to talk about is in the Americas, we're live, as you know, so I would encourage anyone who has any questions about American artifacts or who've come across them in their own world here in the United States, feel it, call in and talk about it, because we're always wanting to expand our wonderful knowledge. I think we talked about the Grave Creek. Is that correct? We were going to talk about
Grave
Creek.
That's correct.
And this is absolutely fascinating to me. You know, it reminds me of runes. As I see the picture of it, I don't know how big it is,
mm-hmm.
but it reminds me of ancient runes for some reason,
nope.
although I understand the hieroglyphics on this
mm-hmm.
were more Semitic.
Well, what you're referring to is something called the Grave Creek Mound, which
right.
is in western Virginia. And the thing is that most Americans, our education is so deficient because we have no idea of the high civilizations that rose and fell on our continent hundreds and thousands of years before our modern civilization got started. We're not talking about just primitive peoples with bows and arrows and hunting buffalo and so on. That
yes.
took place, too. But
yes.
there were other peoples here who created great, fabulous things, giant things,
oh,
far
yes.
bigger than oil lamps. And
yes.
their story is something that's really tackled in Unearthing Ancient America. The Grave Creek Mound that you're referring to
mm-hmm.
is absolutely gigantic. It's about 67 feet tall. It is not just a clump of earth. Something
right.
like 76 million basket loads of earth went into this object. And it isn't just earth. It's a stratification of clay, gravel,
mm-hmm.
different types of earth that has held its shape over the last 2,000 years or more. There's very few things that we're creating today that will be in relatively good shape 2,000 years from now.
Well,
and yet, these people did. These people were known as the Adena. That's what archaeologists
okay.
know them as. We don't know what they really were called.
Right.
Cherokee, interesting you mentioned them. They knew about these people. They referred to them as the Ali or the Aleg. That's probably their name was probably something. But anyway, this mound they created was just magnificent. It is. You can go and visit it today.
Right.
And back in 1830, there were some people that were excavating the mound. There was no archaeology in America at that time. There were just clubs of people known as antiquarians. They had no training. They were enthusiasts. But they did the best they could, and they tried to stay to the scientific method. So this mound, which has been known since about 1790, I guess, when the first people went through there, something like that, probably earlier, was first excavated in 1830, and they dug a vertical trench from the top down just to see what was inside.
Right.
And they got more than they bargained for. They came upon two internal chambers. And they were both the same, these chambers. One was dead center in the mound. The other one was a little lower to the west, I believe. And these chambers were remarkable for several things. One, they were unlike anything else that had ever been found in the Americas at that time, and very few since. They were burial chambers, for sure. And they were arrangements of stone and logs. The logs were laid out very precisely, not haphazardly, very beautifully done. And on the bier, what used to be a decayed away, it was made of material
okay.
that couldn't withstand time, they found the remains of a man that was over 7 feet tall.
Oh.
And the other person found was about 5'9", something like that. Was pretty, but the 7-footer was remarkable. It's since been found that some of these mounds that were opened up contained other people that were 7 feet and more feet tall.
But
so we're dealing with a race of giants. Now, this is not something which is theoretical or fantasy.
Right, right.
This later became hard archaeology. And when these other Adena mounds were opened up often, they found individuals that were of this height, which was far above anything of the native population at that time. Even more remarkable than that was found something much smaller. It's a very small little tablet, hardly more than a pebble, that fits in the palm of the hand. And on this stone were engraved some strange characters. Now, the Native Americans didn't have any written language that anybody knew of.
Uh-huh.
And in three lines, there's this inscription, and there's a representation of a bird's head at the bottom. Nothing like this had ever been found before. Archaeologists were puzzled what this could possibly be, and it was only really until about 15 years ago that a very great epigrapher is someone who specializes in ancient languages, named Donald Buchanan, writing for the New England Research Society, was able to first of all, identify the language that's on this tablet and to identify what this tablet says. The language is Celtic Iberian. In other words, the language that's on this tablet found in West Virginia belonged to someone who spoke the Celtic language and who lived in Spain or Portugal about 2,000 or more years ago. The little tablet is a dedication to not a king, but a kind of a ruler and his wife by the name of Tesech. This is the type of material that we tackle in Unearthing Ancient America, which is not theories, but hard evidence that there were peoples from other parts of the world long before Columbus who arrived in the Americas and interacted with the Native Americans, either positively or negatively, both, and left these tremendous indications of their passage. So our prehistory is not just something of people who migrated across from Siberia, a land bridge into Alaska. That's part of the story, but it's not the only story, the whole story. And that we trace these influences from different parts of the world. Celtic Europe is one, West Africa is another, a lot from Japan. And these essays, we have about 52 essays that are collections of the best articles that were published in our magazine called Ancient American, and put them together in this one volume. So when people say, well, what proof do you have for your claim that there were people here before Columbus? This, I think, represents extremely hard evidence. And it's written in a style for the average person like myself to understand. My job here was not to write so many articles. I wrote some that are in there. But my job mostly was to edit, and I had the privilege of selecting what, in my opinion, were the most persuasive pieces of evidence. And we're talking about not only little tablets like this and seven-footers. By the way, the Celtic people also often achieved a stature of 7 feet. So
you answered my question, because I was going to ask about the Celtic people 2,000 years ago, because today they are not.
They do produce some pretty tall people today, but more commonly in the past. There, of course, over time there's been inbreeding. And
of
some of these genetic traits.
Is it not the food also? Because are we not, for example, over a period of centuries, we grow taller if there's good nutrients in the food, and we go smaller if the land is starved of nutrients?
Well, that certainly is true. If you go to Japan, the Japanese are always noted as a very smallish people in stature. But if you go there today, it's amazing how many tall people you see, native Japanese, because their diet has improved over the last few generations.
Well, that's what I was thinking of, too, because I hadn't known, and at least in the reading I had done, it had never been mentioned that the Celts were that tall. Now, I do know that the Vikings tended to be of great height, gigantic height.
Yeah, they were big too. The Celts were known as being very tall. The Romans talk about them as being, of course, the Romans were a little on the short side themselves. But more importantly than that is that a great many Celtic graves have been opened and identified since about the same time, interestingly, as the Edina graves were opened up.
Really?
And Hallstatt in Austria. It was just a matter of coincidence in a way. While the first Edina mounds, like the Grave Creek Mound, were being opened in the 1830s. About the same time in Germany and Austria, the first Celtic graves were being found.
Oh, really?
And comparisons were not made immediately, but eventually people began to say, well, that's remarkable. You're finding these giants in Austria and Germany, and we're finding these giants over here in the Ohio Valley and in West Virginia. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask, could I tell the color of the hair, for example? Was that left? Or was there no material left?
Well, it's interesting. The Celts were known, of course, they were very fair-haired Nordic people.
Yes.
They were known as being blonde, and they had a lot of redheads amongst them,
Right.
And there is no, so far as I'm aware, there is no hair that has survived from the Celts. However, the tradition of the native peoples about the Aleg or the Alegui often refer to them as red-haired. There's a whole story in Wisconsin about this big chief of the Aleg whose name was Red Hair, as a matter of fact, which is kind of interesting amongst the people who supposedly didn't produce any red hair. It's interesting, too, because redheads are disappearing from the world now.
Really?
According to geneticists, there will be no more redheaded people in the world by the end of the 21st century.
Why?
Because of all the intermarriages taking place. Red hair.
That's a recessive strain?
Well, it's not recessive. It was typical of the white race, but the white race is now is being compromised, if you want to put it that way. Or now intermarriage is taking place so universally now. So the redheads that disappeared in America so long ago are about to disappear throughout the world.
You know what that reminded me as you were talking? I had read about a number of years ago about in the steppes of the Caucasus. That you know where I'm heading, huh? The people's being found there, and they had conical-shaped hats, and it seems that women were honored in that, too. But they were also a very large race of people, that is, tall race of people, and they were surprised because they were not Mongolian, and they appeared to be more European or Celtic, and they were trying to figure out why these people were in that area when it was not known, and it was an ancient people that was not known to be Asian. Mm-hmm. And they were so surprised to find them along some of the pathways in the Gobi Desert.
That's correct.
Region.
Yeah. You're talking about people who have been naturally mummified in parts of northwestern China. And these people were tall, fair-haired, and they wore clothing that had almost a Scottish look to them, like tartans and so forth. These were definitely Celtic peoples who were put on the move because of there was a major climate deterioration in the steppes where they migrated from, and they could no longer farm, and their herds were suffering. So these people dispersed in every direction, and some went, of course, south and initiated civilization in ancient Greece. They were known as the Dorians to the ancient Greeks. These are the same people who went to China. Different tribes preferred to go to different parts of the world, and those people that are now naturally mummified, the graves that were so well preserved because of the dry conditions, they're part of the same migration over time.
I'm going to ask, do you think that's the same migration that came to the United States, or what we do?
That's, I would say no, because the Dorians that went to Greece, for example, and these people that went to China, this took place many thousands of years ago. We don't know how long. There were waves of migration as the climate fluctuated.
Okay.
But these people that are in America, they appear very suddenly in the archaeological record. Bang, 1,000 years before Christ. 3,000 years ago, there was material culture in North America was very low. You had people that were living very close to the natural rhythms of nature. They were migrating, following the animal herds. And then all of a sudden, like a line in the sand, 1000 BC, you have people who are settled in villages who introduce agriculture. There was no agriculture before then. They're raising raspberry gardens. They create walled structures. They create pyramids that have actually made stone pyramids. They're not made of solid stone. The first it was a mound, and then they plated it with great stone blocks. That was in the Ohio Valley. And it's interesting because that's just when the Celts were on the move, and their earliest home appears to be around what is now Poland. And they migrated throughout Western Europe again about 3,000 years ago. This massive migration took place, and population pressures being what they were, some spilled over and they crossed the Atlantic to become the Adena here, the Aleg, as they're remembered by the Cherokee. The Celts were tremendous seafarers. That's another thing that's not well known.
Well, that's what I was thinking of,
When the Celts, for example, Julius Caesar himself, tells us in his wars with the Venetii, and these were a Celtic people, that their ships were much larger than the Roman ships. He defeated them at sea only out of better strategy, but the Celtic ships were far superior to the Roman warships at that time. They were much larger. And what's interesting in his story is that after he defeated the Celts at sea in this battle, he couldn't defeat all of them. There were probably about 1,000 ships. These battles were enormous in those days. And the ships, some of them escaped over the sea, he said. And he did not think they went home because he blocked their way. So that's part of their story that they crossed the seas. The Celts were extremely brave people, so they had no fear of crossing the ocean. Today, archaeologists will say, the ancient people were too afraid to cross the ocean. I don't think the Celts were afraid of anything. The Celts are portrayed by the Romans as being totally fearless and deathless when it came to battle. They just threw themselves into battle. That's one reason why they lost most of the time. The Romans were more cool about it, you know. And
they weren't exactly, but I think some of the ancient people would drink a little schnapps, if you want to call it that way, to drive up, at least the Vikings did.
It's just like the Irish today, you know, they get drunk, take off all their clothes, and get into a fight, and that's just basically what happened then, too. But what's interesting is that when these Celts arrived here in North America, of course, they were quite a minority, but being the great fighters they were, they held on. They built also stone forts, which are you can still see today. There's one called Fort Ancient in southern Ohio. We write about that in the book, too.
Right.
And it's incredible the work they did. They moved to make this fort alone, and they built hundreds of these forts, hilltop forts, to guard their areas. This one fort alone called Fort Hill is the one I'm thinking of. They moved more than 350,000 cubic yards of material to build this one stone fort.
What did they use to move their material?
That's a mystery because even just human labor would not have been enough to do it so well and so quickly, by the way. You had to build these forts fast because the enemy is not waiting for you to finish your fort.
No, not to sit on the hands. No. Mm-mm.
And the Celts did precisely the same thing. They had hill forts called oppidum, or oppida, I guess, in plural. But the oppidum was a stone hill fort in which the Celts also moved hundreds of thousands of raw material to build these things. And they're very similar to the ones that you can see yourself. Our book tells people you don't have to go to Europe or Egypt to see great ancient works. You can just go any place in your own country that it's not discussed as well.
I find that fascinating. Didn't they find also up in Nova Scotia area on some of the islands there mounds that they felt were built by people from Greenland or some other place that came earlier or even more Celts? I'm vaguely remembering that.
The Nova Scotia area and the northern eastern seaboard of the United States was strongly impacted by the Norse, or people from ancient Scandinavia.
Right.
And there's no doubt, archaeologists today have been forced to admit that a place called Lance Meadows, on the coast, was not only a little establishment made by Greenland Vikings, possibly even Iceland Vikings, but more importantly than this 1,000 years ago, what's more remarkable than that is that it was used as a jumping-off point for further exploration of the Americas. And those other points are only now being found. So the Vikings didn't just land here by accident, or they just tentatively visited the coast. They made a thorough exploration of North America and penetrated as far as Minnesota.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, connection there, right?
That's the amazing thing.
They have left artifacts in Minnesota, and you're from that area, aren't you?
Well, I'm in Minnesota now.
I'm originally
from Illinois, but I'm settled here on the Mississippi with my wife and my Norwegian forest cat, as it turns out. He's here with us, too.
So your Norwegian forest cat. Oh, my goodness. What's a Norwegian forest cat?
A Norwegian forest cat is a very interesting sort of a cat. He is known also as the mystical forest cat because these cats are able to climb sheer walls. I've seen them do it occasionally. They just climb straight up. I don't even know how he does it exactly. But the Norwegian forest cat is just a wonderful kitty. Well, anyway, the Kensington Runestone is what you're referring to.
Okay.
And this stone was found in 1890 on a farmer's field. He was clearing his farm.
Okay.
And there was a stump of a large tree, and as he pulled it up with his team of horses, his little son was out there helping him, and he noticed that there was this granite boulder that was caught in the roots of this tree stump, and the boulder was covered with writing, an inscription, many lines, both on its face and on two sides. And the farmer took the stone into town, and luckily he did not clean it, and he was able to see it and as it had been removed. And to make a long story short, the inscription has been competently translated as a runic inscription that was written about 1416 by Norse people from Sweden, from the island of Skane, off the coast of Sweden. And this is a memorial stone that was set up by the leader of the expedition. Now, this is after the Viking Age. The Viking Age lasted from about 800 A.D. to, oh, maybe 1200 at the most. But there were still, of course, Norse people who were had been now converted to Christianity and had left their pagan ways, but still had their maritime technology. And around 1300 A.D. Around 1300 A.D., after the Viking Age, there was a great plague that swept all through Western Europe. And the king of Sweden, whose name was...
Black Plague, was it?
Yes,
no.
It was.
Plague, okay.
And the king of Sweden, whose name was Magnus, dispatched an expedition to find a place of refuge for his people in case they could not survive the plague. This expedition went to Vinland and then beyond Vinland, explored the Great Lakes. This is now back for, a couple hundred years before Columbus ever set sail or was born.
Right.
And they made it they penetrated as far as the interior of Minnesota. And there they ran up against Native American opposition. Five of their men were slain, and this monument was set up as a monument, a memorial to them. The stone was considered extremely controversial. When it was first found, it was regarded by professionals as a fake. And
isn't that interesting how every time something new is discovered, everybody goes running around screaming, fake, fake, fake.
Well, if the archaeologists don't find it themselves, it's a fake.
If they find it,
it's an authentic artifact. That's basically the way it goes.
I see. Okay.
We won't get into that. That's a whole other far more. I can tell you that in the title of the book is called, you know, Unearthing Ancient America. We include the word scoundrels. The scoundrels are the archaeologists.
That's my feeling in some of this.
They're the scoundrels, but that's something else. So the stone was regarded as a fake by most of the professionals, not all of them.
Right,
as a matter
of
fact, in 1949, the head of the Smithsonian re-examined the Kensington Stone and pronounced it authentic. Over all of the opposition of his colleagues, they literally shouted him down. And it's been regarded as controversial. Now we don't know. Some scholars are bringing up things. But the most recent testing is included in Unearthing Ancient America.
Right.
And it absolutely seals the authenticity of this object.
Great.
Because an electron microscope was brought to bear on this inscription for the first time. And the electron microscope examined the cuts that were made in the inscription to make the inscription to determine when they were made, because an electron microscope can do that.
Yes.
To give you a general idea, the electron microscope revealed, and this is not the interpretation of the people working it, this is the instrument itself, revealed that the cuts in the stone could not have been made any time after 500 years ago, and probably before then. So, in other words, the electron microscope almost nailed it exactly to the dates that are inscribed on the stone itself. Now, this is something which has received play in the St. Paul Pioneer Press. So we've got it on the front page of the paper. And the archaeologists immediately chimed in and said that this evidence is not conclusive enough, but they have no counter evidence at all. They have none, and so the article came out rather confused. You know, so people read it and say, like, well, is it or isn't it? But because the archaeologist did not do it again, of course, this man that did it, of course, he's not an archaeologist. He's a geologist. He's not.
Right.
His expertise is not in archaeology. It's in determining the dates of things like the Kensington Runestone. So, in other words, it's more of a precise science, I'm afraid, than archaeology is. But the Kensington runestone, in any case, establishes beyond a question of a doubt that there were people from Scandinavia using kind of Viking technology, maritime technology, to penetrate as far as Minnesota hundreds of years before the Spanish arrived in San Salvador.
Okay.
And that's just part of the evidence. I mean, our book just overflows with evidence from peoples all around the world. America has been a melting pot long before the Statue of Liberty was ever set up. And people that had the maritime technology, they came here and they made a tremendous impact on the whole Native American scene that we know today. So that's basically what the
book proposes. Let me say, I think we had somebody call in. Welcome. Hello. Well, there was a beep, wasn't there? At least I thought I heard a beep. Okay, well, I guess not. As I said, you're certainly welcome to call in and ask questions or even talk about things that you might have found in your own area, things that you've learned about just as I have in digging around and just coming across things in stores and so forth and in little shops. I thought I heard a beep, and I thought somebody wanted to get on the show, but I guess not. This is all fascinating. I have such a passion for this. I don't know where it came from. I've always had a love of learning about history and where we live and how people came to be where we are. It's to me, it's a part of the never-ending story of mankind. And wondering what these people were like, what their lives were like, how did they manage to get there? And of course, there's always the fascinating world of Atlantis and the people that supposedly moved inland when the world broke up, when the lands broke up in the great cataclysms, which I think there are more stories about and proof that indeed lands did break up, if I'm not mistaken. Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Floods, earthquakes, what is it, the shifting of the poles?
It's referred to as a pole shift. That's a rather controversial story, this theory. Far more credible and more than credible, we know for sure, that lands have arisen from the sea and fallen back into the sea. There's no question about that. We now know that our planet is a far more dynamic and actually unstable piece of landscape than was ever imagined before, and that peoples have come and gone. What's remarkable, I think, about this story that you're talking about, and it's not really that remarkable that you're interested in that, because this is your story. This is our heritage. I mean, Americans today are bored out of their minds with history. You can't say that word. It's our story. I mean, we should certainly take an interest in it. It's not just dead facts. These were people just like ourselves who were under an extremely difficult set of circumstances and who achieved greatness. The Aleg or Adena that I'm talking about, they achieved a society which has outstripped our own. They got established here in the Americas 1,000 years before Christ, and their society lasted the next 700 years. That's remarkable. That's far beyond anything we've been able to. We're coming apart at the seams, and we're only a little over 200 years old.
Right.
These people had a society. They lasted and prospered. Their society controlled all of North America from the Mississippi to the Atlantic seaboard.
Wow.
And this was they were iron workers, for example. They had iron foundries, which are now found all over the Ohio Valley.
And what did the archaeologists say about iron foundries, which shouldn't exist?
Well, they're quite upset about it, actually.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Poor baby.
Because they wouldn't be upset if someone just said, they had iron factories and had no proof. The trouble is there have been found literally dozens of Adena iron factories, and so first of all, the archaeologists say, well, they must have been made by colonialists, you know, moved in a long time ago, you know. Well, then when, of course, the testing was done on the iron slag, which is no problem at all, found out that the slag was produced somewhere like around, 100 or 500 years before Christ. Well, I don't think there were too many colonialists from King George's America making iron foundries. Not only that, but the iron foundries that have been found, these ancient iron foundries, are of a completely different type than the colonial iron people,
yeah.
iron workers made. The colonialists, as you might imagine, used brick to build their iron foundries.
Yeah.
These are not
yeah.
made of brick at all. They're made of stone. They're made of rough rock. They're not beautiful
yeah.
things. They're not great archaeological aesthetic achievements, but they worked, and they produced tremendous ironworks. And
well,
the archaeologists either deny that they exist, which is pretty funny because they've been photographed and visited all over, or else they say, oh, well, they dismiss it. You know, oh, they're just all made by colonialists. But it's an inconvenient evidence. But that actually, even those iron foundries, as fabulous as they are
mm-hmm.
nothing compared with what a people called the Hohokam built. And the Hohokam were a people
yes.
who lived out in the southwest of America.
Right.
And they lived out there about 1,000 years ago. And they created furnaces that produced temperatures in excess of 2,000 degrees, enough to be
wow.
able to melt silver. And those huge, powerful furnaces
yeah.
were greater than anything that was known even in the Renaissance world at that time. They created the Hohokam...
Were where? Near the Anasazi? Were they near the Anasazi or the ancient ones or no?
Well, you know, it shows you that you're pretty knowledgeable. Most people are not aware of that, but they were very close allies of the Anasazi. They traveled together. They were a different
okay.
people. They created
okay.
a different society right
so
next
were,
door. They got along extremely well because they were apparently related somehow. But
uh-huh.
they flourished together in the southwest about the same uh-huh. time, about 1,000 years ago. And the Anasazi are these remarkable people in
yes.
a place called Chaco Canyon, New Mexico.
Yes. Yes.
And they built the most remarkable city probably certainly in the world at that time.
No, yes.
This city called Chaco Canyon was connected by over 250 miles of superbly crafted roads. And these roads
yeah.
linked something like 95,000 square miles of territory, if you can believe this.
Wow. I mean, that's like our highway system.
And
today.
It is. These were like super highways. Some of them were 200 feet across. They had a kind of pavement. This is remarkable. And each one of these roads and all of their buildings, their huge buildings they had, they were all of them oriented precisely to the positions of the sun and moon and the movements of the sun
really?
And moon. They built one, for example, called Casa Grande, which was made up of over 50 million bricks, give you an idea how big this thing was. They
Holy
made another
cow.
One. They had another structure, a circular structure, still in existence, called Casa Rinconada, which means the House of the Four Corners. That one is as big as the Roman Colosseum. They built another
wow.
one called Pueblo Bonito. This structure
uh-huh.
was 5 stories high. And each one of these buildings, they were oriented, and the Casa Pueblo, by the way, that had 5 stories high, had over 800 rooms in it. Each one
That's
of these buildings
amazing.
were precisely oriented to mostly the solstices, lunar
okay.
equinox. It's just incredible, and it just flourished a very short time for little more than 150, 170 years.
Uh-huh.
Before that society collapsed, it became into serious conflict with Native Americans who drove
okay.
them out of Casa Rinconada, and they became the cliff dwellers.
Would they also have been due to deteriorating world conditions, climatic conditions like drought, so that it would gradually drain the countryside of sustainable agriculture and other things of that nature? Would that also be a part of it?
You put your finger on it exactly. That's exactly what happened. For 150 years, they built this incredibly prosperous area, land, kingdom, whatever you want to call
uh-huh.
it. The,
uh-huh.
And it was based on water. For them, for us, oil is the
yeah.
driving force of our economy. For them, it was water.
For
they
you.
Were water management engineers of an incredible genius. In the
wow.
middle of the desert, they built a canal system that, if put end to end, would reach from Phoenix, Arizona, beyond the Canadian border. This irrigation system was able to irrigate something like 17,000 square miles of arable land.
Wow, that's better than Romans. That's better than what the Romans did.
It outstripped the Romans.
Really?
It outstripped just about everybody. They were incredible irrigationists. And these were not simple ditches that were outlined in the sand. They were modern irrigation canals. They were coated with cement. They had sluice gates. They could raise and lower the water. They could direct it to different areas. It was so incredible. This is 1,000 years ago. And it worked fine. It worked fine.
Yes.
How did I learn about it?
Why don't we? Why don't we learn about it? We, the Americans, learn about what's been in our own country.
Isn't that a scandal? Isn't that a scandal? We don't know about this. We're not told in the schools. We're told about things that are completely ignore this. What a proud heritage that we have here. And it takes independent researchers to go dig this information out, and that's the idea of course, Unearthing Ancient America, is to make it popularized, to make it and put it into a setting so that the ordinary American is acquainted with these things. But its society collapsed because, it's exactly as you say, Phyllis, the climate went through a severe deterioration. It was known as the Little Ice Age. It was all over the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah. Okay,
and it affected us. It affected the Americas just as severely as it affected
That's what I mean.
Europe.
It was not only there, but it was here and around the world. With the dot, I would assume it would also have been in Africa, and it was due
not
to
as much. No, not as
not
much.
As much.
Mostly the Northern Hemisphere. It was a band that would extend, say, from the Arctic Circle down to maybe the Mediterranean area.
What caused
that?
Do we know? Was it volcanic activity that caused global warming? Freezing, really. I didn't want to say it's the opposite of global warming. It's when there's not enough sunlight gets through.
There is still a great deal of controversy on what caused the mini ice age, and serious controversy, because if it happens again, it would have serious repercussions for us here.
Right.
It seems to have been related to sunspot activity in some way.
Okay.
And that's about all that the general consensus is, what exactly caused the mini ice age. Our planet, as I said, is an extremely dynamic and complex world.
Mm-hmm.
And we're far from understanding all of the systems that go into it.
Mm-hmm.
But this mini ice age that struck dried up agriculture, and it was no longer possible to use the canals as effectively as they were used before. By that time, native peoples, had been attracted to the Chaco Canyon area and the areas around it, and had become very prosperous. We're dealing with a very prosperous society.
Right.
All of a sudden, the economy dried up. People got very angry. And the reason why they got angry was because the Anasazi, who were the leaders of the society, claimed that everything came, all the power came to them through the gods. And it looked as though now, that was a dangerous claim to make, because it looked as though the gods had withdrawn their favor from the Anasazi. And as a consequence, there was major social dislocation, revolutions, if you want to put it, anarchy. And society, places like Chaco Canyon were no longer tenable. The crime waves became untenable. It's very similar to what we're going through today. Parts of our cities are unlivable.
Yes.
Chaco Canyon became unlivable. And
We did get a beep.
Okay.
Did someone come on? Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Jay.
I'm loving your show. Fascinating. I just kind of tuned in about 15 minutes ago. Who's the guest, please?
This is Frank Joseph, who's written The Unearthing Ancient America. Where are you from, sir?
Asheville, North Carolina.
Now that's got some beautiful places down there, sir. I know Asheville. I used to go to camp down there.
Okay.
What would you like to talk about, or would you like to ask?
Well, I want to know the name of the book. Is the book published? Is the book out?
Sure.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's called Unearthing Ancient America.
Unearthing Ancient America, is that the title?
That's correct, sir. And you can get it at Barnes & Noble or Borders. If they don't have copies there, some stores don't, you can just ask them and they'll get it for you. The book came out only a few months ago. It's a new book.
Okay. Well, Amazon would have it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, Amazon definitely carries it, right.
Yeah, yeah. So now, I do have a question. So you were talking about this civilization down in the Southwest that had the sophisticated canal system. What was their name again?
Those people were called the Hohokam, H-O-H-O-K-A-M. We don't know exactly what they really called themselves. That's how archaeologists refer to them. And that's how the Native American Pima Indians remember them. The name Hohokam is really a descriptive name. It means the old ones. But what they really were called, we don't know, because they completely vanished about 1300 A.D. Many of them were wiped out. They died in the anarchy that took place, that swept over the Southwest. And others apparently migrated to Mexico, where they merged with the population. That's what appears to have happened. But their society was overthrown.
And you said they had cement canalways?
They had cement canalways.
Yes.
These were huge affairs. It is. It's a cement called caliche, C-A-L-I-C-H-E. And it was ground up using mollusk shells, water, mud, and some other elements that are not known. But it makes a very effective, very powerful cement. And some of this caliche cement in these canals, quite a lot of it, has been found by archaeologists who were amazed at the durability of these cement canals. The cement canals, we don't even know the full extent of them. They were literally thousands of miles long.
And the thing is, where the sand hill did they get those mollusk shells to use in the middle of the desert, for God's sake?
We do know where they got those mollusk shells. They got them from Southern California. They had an entire industry in Southern California to gather up as much shell as possible and then to transport it to what is now the Phoenix, Arizona area. That's where this society was headquartered, and they imported tons and tons of these shells, which were ground up to be used in their canal system.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. And they had sluice gates. They were able to divert the water to anywhere they wanted. It was the canals were so huge that they used balsa wood boats to travel throughout their realm on the canals. They used an extremely efficient transportation system. You could get on certain canals you were allowed to put your balsa wood boat and you could scoot through the desert on these through the canal system. Their main city was called Snake Town and had like about 12,000 people residing there. And some of the houses were way ahead of their time. They built the houses on kind of stilts, amazingly enough. Well,
yeah.
I don't want to get into that. it's a great
on
system.
And on.
you can read about some of these things in Unearthing Ancient America.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi. Do we know what they looked like physically?
Yes, somewhat. They left behind a great many little statuettes. They did not build large statues, figurines. And these figurines, thousands of them have been found. They were used in funeral practices, it would appear.
Okay.
And so we have somewhat an idea of what they look like. They're crude little figures. They were beautifully dressed. They had like long robes, and they did their hair up very nicely. We do know somewhat what the Hohokam looked like, but none of their bodies remain. They appear to have been involved in cremation. That's why we don't know what they looked like. We do know what the Anasazi looked like, and the Anasazi were contemporary with these people. The Anasazi created mortuaries where you had natural mummification taking place. And so we do know what we have mummies of some of the Anasazi, and we do know what they look like. They also physically differed from the Native American people. They were referred to as more gracile. In other words, they had finer features. Their hair appears to have been finer, not as heavy or as coarse. They were tall. Some of the Anasazi were very tall and slender.
Yeah.
But the Hohokam, we don't know what they look like too well, except from these little figurines, because they cremated their dead.
Well, thank you. Fascinating. I really appreciate your information.
It's interesting. Yeah. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy the book.
Yes,
well,
absolutely.
Thank you. I will. Yeah.
Thank you for calling in.
Okay, you're welcome.
Great, thank
Bye-bye.
You. Right. Anyway, this is just wide-ranging. Isn't this wonderful? I'm so glad somebody called in, because it's so important to have this kind of thing. You know, I think when children are in the third grade, they're 8 or 9 years of age, do you know that they have this absolute fascination for the world around them? I think that's when they begin to realize the sun does not rise and set on their little tushies, you know? And they have an absolute fascination. And I had some of the artifacts that I have, and I took to a third grade class in public school in D.C., and the children were absolutely fascinated by it. And the teacher wanted me to come again, but I guess she must have lost my phone number or something, because I never heard from her the following year. But the kids were all so fascinated to learn about this. And if you can get them at a young age, you've got them for the rest of your life, as far as I can see.
No, I agree with you 100%, and that's where our education, I think, has really failed, not just in terms of history, but it doesn't preserve the sense of wonder throughout life that children are naturally born with. That it stamps it out, if anything, and tries to make them into a good little businessmen and women, when in fact their sense of wonder should be perpetuated, and history is, of course, a part of that.
Well, the other thing is, a part of being a good business person is also that sense of wonder and excitement, and that's what people don't seem to understand. You know, when you have that passion for learning, it translates into passion to finding about business and growing. It's all a part of the human psyche, if that makes sense. At least that's my understanding.
Well, I think so. It certainly improves It improves the quality of life in order to be passionately interested in something that doesn't really concern yourself personally necessarily, but winds yourself up into it personally. You become really fascinated with how did all this begin, and the great lesson that comes out in this is that other civilizations on our continent have risen to greatness and flourished for a long time. And they went into decline and utterly vanished. Well, that's a tremendous lesson for our time, because why would a society like the Hohokam, the people who went to so much work and flourished so well, what happened? Why aren't they here today? They probably assumed that they would be around forever, because they had lasted for a very long time. Like the Adena, they flourished for 700 years. So if you talk to somebody in the middle of that society, they think, well, they'd be around forever. And they're here to stay. But they weren't. Why did they disappear? So are we to assume that we have a perpetual lease on history?
Yes, of course
these
we
people
do. We do, don't we? In our own ignorance, we do. We think each one seems to think that the other is a lesser.
I guess so. You know, we have this really snobbish attitude on the past that everybody was inferior to us, you know, because we didn't have atomic bombs and refrigerators and televisions, you know, that they're all just nothing, you know. But in a way, in some regards, they were superior to us because their civilization has lasted much longer than ours has so far.
Oh, yes, I know. As I said, I am absolutely fascinated by all of this. I just love what I'm learning. Even talking to you, I've read a lot, and as you can see, I started becoming interested in this when I was in grade school, as a matter of fact. And we had the book library on wheels, and the library would come in D.C. And I'd run out of books, and then the librarian would pick up other books when she found out whatever era I was interested in. She'd pick up books for me, and so I'd read about 5 books a week. And every week I was there on a Friday evening picking up books. I had to take a bus.
Well, isn't that great? Isn't that, yes. That's wonderful. Well, it really shows, because you really follow this argument quite well, and you've been ahead of me on a great many things, so you obviously understand. But I think that what you're saying is that anybody that really gets into this ignites a passion that sustains them their whole life long.
Exactly, and it translates into business. It translates into learning. Not only that, but other things, because there's so much that evolves. You're talking about nutrition. You're talking about health, ancient healing. And we go back to Native Americans and showing healing, like to Walter Reed, who found out that the Native Americans showed him the bark of a tree they chewed on so they would not get malaria. But he equated with discovering quinine, okay? So the thing is, there are so many different ways that this path leads you into the present and the future.
That's right.
That I can't understand why there isn't this love of learning that just transcends everything. But then, you know, I've always been a little weird on the side.
Well, there's a reason for that, because history is dangerous. History is dangerous. History is politics. And it's a view of the past. And if it turns out that a particular historical event sheds a rather unflattering light on what's going on today, people react strongly to that, and they either deny it or reinterpret it, or else mostly they don't like to even discuss it. So history can be dangerous. The difference between, I think, Unearthing Ancient America and other books is that we don't give a damn about politics at all.
That's true.
And we
want
to know what really happened. What's the truth? What really took
place?
We don't have we have zero political agendas.
I'm not trying
to please anybody.
No.
We have no theories, nothing. We just bring out exactly what happens from the evidence. Let the evidence speak for itself.
Yes.
And the evidence brings out a story which is radically different than what we're taught in the schools.
Well, it's a mystery. It's a murder mystery sometimes, or a wonderful mystery, a clue game. We need to stop, because we are coming to the, would you believe we've been on the phone almost an hour?
Oh.
Would you believe? Oh, what a fascination. Thank you so much, Frank Joseph, for being my guest today. You've been an absolute joy. I thank the caller for coming in. And down the road, I'd like to have you back on, because, you know, this is one of my passions, as you can see, and I'd love, perhaps in June, you'd like to come on. Would you like to?
Well, of course. I had a really wonderful time, and
I'm at your
disposal.
And, again, your book is Unearthing Ancient America, and the people can get it, as you mentioned. And is there a phone number where they can reach you, or a website, sir?
Well, they can call this toll-free number. It's 1-877-494-0044. And that's the telephone. It's 24 hours a day for the magazine that I work for. And you can order the copy through there. Or they can go on the website, Amazon.com. They can get the book there. Or Barnes & Noble and Borders. Unearthing Ancient America has only been out for a couple of months, a few months. And so they should be able to get it. It has about 100 photographs in there, so it's not just discussion. Makes a pretty good case, I hope.
It makes wonderful reading for anybody who's interested. I loved it. I read it, and I'm so glad. Thank you so much. God bless you all, and we will welcome you next week when Steve Real is going to be on. And he has written another book called Drunk with Wonder. And you might want to listen to that, Mr. Joseph, because it's not it's in your alley, but from a spiritual standpoint. And
sounds
it is
really
a
attractive.
Wonderful book. God bless you, and thank you, and God bless you all. Have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.